Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide, here in Tandunya, on the lands of Kanamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to Elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show...
Many Holocaust survivors or people who have Holocaust survivors in their family support in every possible way the Palestinian people. If the Holocaust is a factor now, it might explain the silence of the Western world.
Dr. Jarboe is a senior psychiatrist working in Palestine, and she believes that the resistance there has lessons for all of us, especially in the West. Also, a new bill is set to give the Education Department more power to cut funding to childcare centres that aren't meeting the bar. But the move has raised questions around other regulations like preliminary checks. And later...
The pilots were no longer able to control the aircraft, so he ordered us to bail out. The hatch was open, I couldn't get out, so I got back into the aircraft quickly and faced forward and pushed myself out through the door.
It's been 80 years since the end of World War II. Max Barry was an airman in the Royal Australian Air Force. Now aged 101, he shares his story. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, could AI pose a new threat? Authors are fearing a proposed shift in copyright laws could give power to tech giants for use of creative works without permission or payment. The Productivity Commission's interim report recommends a text and data mining exemption, pitched to reveal $116 billion in economic growth. A move backed by tech leaders like Scott Farquhar, who says it could unlock billions of dollars of investment. But writers and publishers warn it could undermine creative ownership and strip value from the work of Australian authors, with ASA CEO Lucy Haywood calling it an entirely absurd proposition that gives tech companies a free pass. The Wire's Jordan Zarella with the story.
Well, like many authors, I'm absolutely furious and disgusted about this proposal.
Author and the Deputy Chair of the Australian Society of Authors, Jennifer Mills, says she is disappointed at the findings of the interim report.
It is not only allowing something to happen, but what they've actually done is they've already stolen our work. And what they want to do is change the law afterwards to make this theft a legal act. And I can't think of any other industry where a company would be allowed to steal somebody's work and then change the rules to make that okay.
The ASA, which is you're also part of, said most authors don't receive wages, but they do have copyright. As an author yourself, how important is copyright to you and your ability to and others to make a living?
It's hugely significant, and it's not just the dollar amount of copyright payments, it's also the acknowledgement and the respect that you are the maker of that work. You might spend 3 years, 4 or 5 years working on a book. It's a long grind. You work really hard to perfect the text, to get a meaning across, to create a story. Some work is heavily researched. It's just an incredible amount of labor, and that is already really, really poorly compensated. So the fact that Australia has robust copyright is something that is so valuable to artists and writers and musicians and everybody.
Writing in the digital age is a challenge, where authors experience fierce competition and fluctuating income. Dr. Alice Grundy, Managing Editor of Australia Institute Press, says softening Australia's existing copyright legislation could add another layer of difficulty and offer no benefit to the author.
This would mean a softening of Australia's existing copyright legislation, and that these AI companies, which use large language models, would be able to effectively use Australian creators' content to train their large language models without paying a fee. So this would effectively mean forfeiting the coverage that Australian law currently provides for Australian creatives.
Scott
Farquhar, the chair of the Tech Council of Australia. He recently said that the proposed copyright exemption for AI could unlock billions of dollars of investment and help Australia compete globally. Others, including many organisations, argue it undermines creative ownership. From your perspective, how should Australia weigh the economic potential of AI against the rights for creators?
Well, the first point is we have no clear evidence that handing over wholesale all of this creative material is going to have a tangible benefit in terms of productivity. I don't accept the idea that this will automatically lead to increased profits, increased investments, more money in people's pockets. But even if that were true, we have to ask ourselves the questions of how important is Australian culture to us and what price do we put on that?
CEO of Australian Copyright Council, Aileen Camilleri, says the current framework already draws a clear line if AI uses creative work outside fair dealing, it's copyright infringement. Ms. Camilleri says she is in full support of Art Minister Tony Burke's stance, saying Australia has no need to weaken copyright laws.
We don't know what that provision would look to the existing fair dealing exceptions. So in Australia, for it to be fair dealing, it has to be for one of those purposes, but it also has to be fair. Now, the court would look at a bunch of factors and it has to do it on a case-by-case basis.
With Tony Burke, he said just recently, and I quote, "We have copyright laws. We have no plans, no intention, no appetite to be weakening those copyright laws." How would you react to this in terms of the current legal approach to AI and our copyright laws?
Well, the council would support that 100%. We say that the Copyright Act already covers the landscape. So if copyright material is reproduced without the permission of the copyright owner outside of those designated exceptions, then it's an infringement of copyright.
The Wire's Jordan Zarella with that story.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
It's been 80 years since World War II ended for Australia when Japan formally surrendered, an event also known as VJ Day. Max Barry, now aged 101, was a young airman in the Royal Australian Air Force, and in 1945, his aircraft was shot down over northern France. The young pilot from Beaufort, Victoria, had a certain skill which saved his life. Speak some French. Powered Media's Emma Myers with the story.
I wanted to learn to fly. It was part of my wish to learn to fly, and that the way to get in.
Can you describe the day your plane was shot down?
Well, we'd been bombing some railway yards in France and west of Cherbourg, west of the peninsula. Suddenly, big flames were coming past port side about a metre away from where I was sitting. So I alerted the pilot that we were on fire. The mid-upper gunner did the same. The engineer took action to put the flames out. The pilot was no longer able to control the aircraft, so he ordered us to bail out. Hatch was open. I couldn't get out, so I got back into the aircraft quickly and faced forward and pushed myself out through the door. Floated down in the dark in my parachute.
Wow, that's incredible. Were you scared? What were you feeling in that moment?
I was wondering what was going to happen to me down below in the dark, and I felt the branches of the tree on the ground.
You spent a month hiding in a barn? You spent a month hiding from the Germans?
I walked north 4 weeks, talking to the French people. Fortunately, I'd learnt French at school. My French was better than usual because a lady in the town who originally came from Switzerland took the leaving class. So we walked into the gate and talked only French for an hour, and that was helpful a year later.
I read that you were hiding in a farmhouse.
I'd been to a small village and no Germans around, so I knocked on the door and a lady came out. So she came out with a big jug of milk and said, "How much do you like? 1 litre or two?" I didn't know what a litre was, but those days, but two sounded better than one. So I took two and drank a lot. She was surprised. She seemed friendly, so I told her I was an English airman on the run. She said, "We have a farm down that lane. If you go there, we'll leave some food out at night for you." And that's what they did.
Was it a clean barn? Were there mice running around? What were the accommodations?
I was upstairs in the first level. I was there for about a week before the boy who worked on the farm came down early in the morning and said, "Get out quickly because the Germans were in the village." So I grabbed my bag and took off. And about three fields away, a German army man said, "Halt." We spoke in French. My French was better than his for a while, but then he said, "Papier, papier." I had no papier, no papers. I was then arrested, walked up to a small town nearby and interrogated by a German army captain. The next day they handed me over to the Luftwaffe people. I was then taken to an interrogation place near Paris and became a POW.
What were your first thoughts when you heard that the war had ended?
Oh, well, I'd be able to get on the way home.
Were you still in the camp when you heard?
19th of January, 45. All our people were marched out to 3:30 in the morning to walk towards Germany. It was very cold, snow everywhere. We walked about 20 k's that morning. The next day, we had to take off again early.
And it's been 80 years since the end of the war. Does it feel that way to you?
Well, the years passed quickly.
Having lived over 100 years, witnessing and experiencing various world events, do you think society learns from the past, or do we just go in a circle?
Well, I suppose we certainly learned some things, that the Nazi system wasn't suitable for us. Fortunately, we were able to change, to stop that.
What do you make of what's happening today in the world?
Well, it's a bit difficult to know. Mr. Trump is quite unpredictable and he tends to throw his weight around.
Australian veteran Max Barry speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
As the ongoing traumatic events in Israel and Palestine, particularly in Gaza, continue, the mental health impacts are huge. And treatment must take into account the impact of colonisation, according to renowned Palestinian psychiatrist, author and human rights advocate, Dr. Sumar Jabur. She works in Palestine and says the role of health workers in Gaza is an inspiration for the rest of the world. Her new book is called Radiance in Pain and Resilience, The Global Reverberation of Palestinian Historical Trauma. It explores the intersections of trauma, collective resilience and mental health. The Wire's Nikki Page spoke with Dr. Jabur for more.
During my studies in medicine, I was training in different parts of the West Bank and in Jerusalem. And I noticed that there are many people who come to see the general doctor for medically unexplained symptoms. And I remember a woman coming from a village of Ramallah, and she could not see. So we sent her to the ophthalmology hospital, and her report came back. She had no organic cause for the loss of vision. And her story, she observed her son being shot in his eye, and she lost her vision after seeing what happened to her child. At that point, I decided to specialize in psychiatry. I understood very quickly that I need to take into consideration political and social factors that cause a lot of suffering and pain. So I had to start rethinking the Western training and approach. Mainstream psychology and psychiatry usually tends to attribute the suffering to a personal dysfunction. That will push many people away from our services. liberation psychology doesn't take into consideration only our individual stories. It also takes into consideration the structural conditions that interact with the individual. So that's my practice of liberation psychology in Palestine. Psychiatry and medicine have contributed significantly to making colonization acceptable. I think that we Palestinians have the responsibility of generating knowledge from our own context. And if we are open to learning from our patients, this is a very helpful resource.
Dr. Jaba, let's just move to your book, Radiance in Pain and Resilience, The Global Reverberation of Palestinian Historical Trauma.
When I use the word radiance, we know that a smile can radiate, sunshine can radiate. When we talk about pain and resilience, the pain of the Palestinians can be felt in different parts of the world. Many nations who experienced colonization, many people whose ancestors were involved in colonization have inherited the shame and guilt. And at the same time, the resilience of the Palestinian people, and we call it Sumud, can be inspiring. Palestinians can export their resilience to the world, their Sumud. This is our gift to the world.
The risk to health workers in Gaza of being killed is 2.4 times the risk to others there, because they are being targeted.
The health system is a lifeline for Palestinians. So to target the health system means to inflict more killing and erasure on the Palestinian people. And this is not accidental. This is by plan. And I think they demonstrated an unusual expression of resilience. I used to go to Gaza and train colleagues there, and I know that most of them multiplied their capacity to respond to the crisis. They work for long hours. They speak about their observations. The occupation doesn't want positive role models for the Palestinian people. So they go after everyone who would be a positive role model.
So many of us watch the news about the continuing trauma, not only the trauma of Palestinians, but the historical trauma of Jews around the world.
Well, every colonization did something similar to what Israelis are doing now without the Holocaust in the background. French colonization did similar things. The colonization of the Congo. They are going by the recipe book of colonization. So I don't think that the Holocaust is a factor. We know many Holocaust survivors or people who have Holocaust survivors in their family who support in every possible way the Palestinian people. I think if the Holocaust is a factor now, it might explain the silence which is allowing so much harm to come upon Palestinians. Why the world allowed a global anti-apartheid movement to end the apartheid regime in South Africa, while the solidarity movement with Palestine now is being attacked in every possible way in Western countries. I think the silence of the Western world particularly can be explained by the Holocaust and their involvement in the Holocaust.
Palestinian psychiatrist, author and human rights advocate, Dr. Sumar Jabur, speaking with The Wire's Nikki Page. Dr. Jabur is currently visiting Australia and New Zealand, Aotearoa, hosted by the Schieffer Foundation. Issues in early childcare regulation and legislations are under the microscope, following the case of alleged sexual misconduct in Victoria. Consequently, the Australian Parliament has issued a new bill that gives the Department of Education the power to cut funding to childcare centres that aren't up to standards. But there are worries about required regulations and the accessibility of credentials like working with children's checks. Delaney Carter asked Monash University's Professor Rosemary Sheehan what changes in early childhood education should be happening.
What I'd like to see is much more attention to quality and safety and to regulation around staff training and numbers of staff employed by centres, and returning the focus to being about care and education rather than simply, if you like, containment of children. What we've seen is that essential social services like childcare have been turned into a business and to becoming a sector of the economy. And that's taken away from the idea that childcare is actually a social necessity and a support. And the flow-on impact of that has led to the range of problems that have emerged and, of course, have emanated in terms of the crisis and the questioning of how effective working with children checks are and what more can be done to perhaps tighten up that system or what additional measures need to be put in place. So it's been excellent to have a discussion that's been opened up about these various important issues, but a lot more discussion needs to be made.
One of those discussions is the bill that was recently passed to cut funding to childcare centres that aren't up to par.
I think in principle it's a very welcome response to the failure of the current supervision of the childcare industry. And I think the government is to be congratulated for moving on doing it. But the challenge is actually in its implementation with the multi-layer of governance that we have across the childcare sector. We've got the federal government that's certainly in control of the taxpayer subsidies, but the states are actually in control of the operation regulation. And this is not coordinated across the Australian states and territories. And some of the other challenges, I think, that emerge from the introduction of this piece of legislation that are really yet to be thought through, for example, what are the thresholds that are going to be put in place to say what constitutes a breach and what ought to be considered in terms of funding and closure? I think that creates a level of ambiguity and uncertainty around what exactly is going to be looked for.
Well, that separation between state and territory, it has been addressed almost 10 years ago by the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse, saying that working with children's systems should be nationalised. So why hasn't this happened?
We have, as you know, we've got effectively 8 different governments, 6 state and 2 territory governments, each with its own legislation about child protection, child welfare, child wellbeing. We've got each jurisdiction having its own autonomy over child welfare. And until we find some way where we have a coordinated federal response to those important matters of welfare, then we're going to continue to have what is effectively a piecemeal approach to child wellbeing and protection.
And what kind of regulations do you think would be strict enough to prevent these issues?
I think it goes back to being a multi-layered response. Let's look at what made effective childcare before we turned essential social services into businesses. It was about the way we set up proper programs for children, the training of staff, the numbers of staff, and the nature of, I suppose, care provision, as in the simple numbers of cots in a room, the way children were allowed to play and the safety around that. And I think without tackling those key issues around how to deliver an effective service, I think we're going to struggle to offer really effective services across the childcare sector.
Professor Rosemary Sheehan from Monash University, speaking with Delaney Carter. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandanya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show brought to you by Mamina Shakur at 4EB in Melbourne. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.